Today at the Globe Observatory, we're pleased to welcome Mr. Alfred Desires, who is the independent expert on the promotion of a democratic and equitable international order. Thank you, Mr. Desires, for agreeing to have this interview with us. So my first question for you is that your mandate calls for a broad analysis of obstacles to a democratic and equitable international order. Can you describe what this mandate specifically entails?
As you know, it's a new mandate. It was created last year, 2012. I am the first mandate holder, so I'm giving it shape. It is a convergence of civil, political, economic, social, and cultural rights. Imagine promoting an international order that is more democratic and more equitable. That entails everything. It is the most universal mandate that has ever been created. I am supposed to identify obstacles. I have done so in my first two reports to the Human Rights Council and my separate, different two reports to the General Assembly. Obstacles, of course, are multiple. And the core of democracy, as I said in the discussion today, there's not one single model of democracy, but we can all agree on the basis of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the modalities of applying the Universal Declaration of Human Rights can be, country to country, adjusted according to the cultural diversity, the traditions of those countries. As far as advancing with democratic order domestically, whether it be in Asia or in Latin America or in Africa, is not the label that is important. What is crucial is this correlation between the will of the people, the needs of the people, and the governmental policies that affect them. That's why I have particular interest in the model of direct democracy, which is the kind of government in Switzerland, for instance, where the population has the right of initiative with a certain number of signatures. You can initiate legislation, or you can test legislation that is, or rather a bill that is before Parliament, or even a piece of legislation that has been adopted. You can have a referendum to abrogate it. You also have recall and impeachment. These are guarantees that the people are the sovereign. That functions very well in Switzerland because Switzerland is a very advanced country with many centuries, actually, of experience in practicing democracy. But since democracy is a concept that is new in certain countries, there's no tradition of democracy, you cannot impose it top-down. You have to assist these countries in developing not only the constitution, obviously the constitution will guarantee democracy, and most laws that are adopted will, on the face of them, be democratic. But unless you have a mechanism for implementation of these norms, you're going to find that it's on the surface democratic, but in reality still autocratic. Again, you have to be patient. You cannot force it. I think that all African countries are making considerable progress toward democracy. It should not come from the West. I really object to the arrogance of some who think that we can export democracy. I think it must be homegrown so that you own it, so that you feel this is us. And the African Union has a very important role to play. There is not only the African Charter on human and people's rights, and everything is in there, basically, the rights and the duties. And you have the African Charter on governance and elections, etc. The groundwork has been laid. It's now a matter of transparency. It is a matter of putting national resources where they should be. One of the problems in many countries, unfortunately, is that national resources are being squandered, are being wasted in military. Most African countries really do not need a large military. They certainly do not need state-of-the-art planes or state-of-the-art tanks and more weapons. It is really a crime to spend tax money instead of putting it into education, putting it into healthcare, to put this money into weapons. And that fuels not only wars, that's evident, but it also fuels corruption. Because to make these big deals, selling armaments, there's usually commissions and there are retro commissions, etc. So there's a whole complex of corruption that accompanies the military-industrial complex and the trade in weapons. So one additional problem that you have to tackle is the problem of accountability. When government squanders money and it does not use it for what the people want and what the people need, then these authorities should be made to account and there should be no impunity. The problem of impunity in Africa is grave, but of course, it's not only in Africa. You have impunity in almost every country because the powerful will do whatever is necessary to retain their power, their privileges, their advantages, and in order to do that, they will bend the law.
Thank you very much for that answer. I think the next question I had for you, you've sort of answered, which is how do you anticipate to engage with the African countries? So if you could pick up on that. And the other question I had is, your recent report, the Human Rights Council, focuses primarily on the issue of participation. Within Africa, what key groups have you identified as being the least able to participate in decision-making processes and institutions, and what obstacles prevent their participation?
Well, let me answer the last question first. The poor are essentially disenfranchised. The uneducated, the illiterate, are disenfranchised. It is very difficult to mobilize this population because their priorities are elsewhere. We know the work of Jean Ziegler and the work of Olivier de Schutter as a rapporteur on the right to food. People have, first and foremost, the right to life. And in order to sustain life, you need food and you need water and you need shelter. These are the day-to-day worries of very many people. If you have extreme poverty, these people are really not terribly concerned about high-flying ideas of democracy or of elections and election monitoring. Their priorities are elsewhere. So it is an urgent need in all African countries to devote a greater percentage of the national budget to eradicating illiteracy, to eradicating child mortality, to eradicating extreme poverty, as indeed reflected in the Millennium Development Goals and in the post-2015 Development Agenda. As to what I personally can do, I have in past years, not since I have the mandate, actually from earlier, I had established contacts with the African Commission on Human Rights, with the African Court on Human Rights. I follow what the meetings of the African Union, and it is on my agenda. So I said, I am a newcomer. I am just recently appointed as a rapporteur. Africa is certainly on my agenda, and I will advance with these contacts as I draft my future reports to the Human Rights Council and to the General Assembly. But as I said also in the discussion, I have regular contact with ambassadors from Africa in Geneva. I participate on very many panels of the Human Rights Council side events organized by African groups on African issues. So I am still in the stage of learning.
So my last question to you is something that I know I've read is close and dear to your heart, that you're an advocate for a World Parliamentary Assembly. So how in practice would such an assembly work? And do you think it would enhance a more democratic and equitable international order?
I'm happy that you posed this question because my heart is very much in it. I believe that a World Parliamentary Assembly, or if you want, a United Nations Parliamentary Assembly, could be established, linked to the United Nations system by virtue of Article 22 of the United Nations Charter. Initially, it would be a consultative body. You're not going to create a legislative assembly side by side to the General Assembly. But you are aware the General Assembly is made up of 193 states members and observer members. But who sits in the assembly? It's governments. It's ambassadors. And to what extent do these 193 ambassadors really represent their constituencies? You know, I know that there is a huge disconnect between power and the people. And many democracies in name essentially are lobby democracies. And they function, cater to special interests, cater to corporations, cater to the oil industry, etc. And they don't really cater to citizen A or citizen B. You have the opportunity once every 2 years or every 4 years to put a little cross on a ballot box. But democracy is not just the ballot box. Democracy is the correlation of needs, political will of the population, and actual policy. That's why the possibility of identifying your priorities is so important. The possibility of having transparency, fiscal transparency and budget transparency is crucial if you're going to have this correlation between needs and policy. Now, a World Parliamentary Assembly could initially borrow, if you want, the already existing parliamentarians of those countries who have already been elected. And then you could start first with parliamentarians who are already in office, and they could then participate in this consultative body, work in progress, called a World Parliamentary Assembly. Eventually, the idea is to have directly elected representatives, which means instead of having just professional diplomats, you would have artisans, and you would have plumbers, and you would have architects, and you would have lawyers, and you would have doctors. You would have a cross-section of society of all countries represented. The book that just came out by Professor Joseph Schwarzberg from the University of Wisconsin, I can highly recommend it. It's called Transforming the United Nations. It really is an architecture for a workable world. It makes very concrete proposals, not only how to reform the General Assembly and the Security Council and ECOSOC, but also how to establish a United Nations Parliamentary Assembly. So I find it entirely feasible, and the number of advocates of the United Nations Parliamentary Assembly has been growing exponentially. Just 2 weeks ago, I attended a conference at the European Parliament, hosted by the European Parliament, welcomed by the President of the European Parliament, who has endorsed the idea of the United Nations Parliamentary Assembly, in which scholars from many countries participated. We adopted the Declaration of Brussels, and there you will see the modalities, the details of what is an entirely future-oriented project that will, and I am confident of that, it will end up in a parliamentary body that will be genuinely representative of citizens. And in this connection, I repeat my call to the General Assembly yesterday to declare World Parliament Day. We already have a World Day on Democracy, but a World Parliament Day in order to celebrate the existence of parliaments and to underline the crucial importance of parliaments in representative democracy.
Thank you very much again, Mr. Desires. That was very informative.